British Spy Stories, Season 1. Spy or Traitor? Episode 23. The Ursprung Café sits in the lower levels of the vast, cathedral-like Dussmann das Kultur Kaufhaus bookshop on Friedrichstrasse, 10 minutes from the bluff yellow brutalism of the British Embassy in Berlin. Hans descends the escalator to the café floor and sees Mel already sat at one of the tables, her loose dark hair just touching the shoulders of her gabardine jacket. She makes a small wave when she sees him and stands to hug. They order coffees and cake, and she explains that she can afford a bit of time as Marcus is on a trip to London for a couple of days. They talk about their work and how good it is to be able to chat to someone who knows the business, so they don't have to keep tracking whether the facts in any of their stories nudge up against the limitations of the Official Secrets Act. Mel likes him. He can tell from her behaviour. She touches the back of his hand more than once as she talks, but he doesn't do the same to her. They're both single. Mel had a long-term boyfriend in her last posting in Paris, but it hadn't worked out. The guy was married, she says to Hans, and watches his face for any judgment, but none comes. Mel already knows that Hans's girlfriend died 5 years ago, in a car accident. He told her during a cozy late-night drink a year ago, when an embassy office party had gone on to a downstairs bar somewhere near the Brandenburg Gate.
"You should get a girlfriend," she says, smiling at him.
"I don't know."
"You need to be looked after."
Another hand touch.
"If I do decide to do that, you'll be the first to know," he says.
"Looking forward to it."
"I wanted to ask you," he begins. "How's work?"
Okay,
she says.
"You like Murphy?"
"Bit of a twat."
Hans laughs, trying to recover the intimacy of the last minute.
"Why is he a twat?"
"He's got secretive,"
she says.
"I know all the details of his operations. I see it all. Even half of his eyes only stuff. Then suddenly, a few days ago, he just clams up."
"Weird. What did he do then?"
"No pattern, really."
"What was the last time?" says Hans.
"That's Stranraer. I asked him a question about it and he went all secret squirrel on me."
"Yeah, that was a tragedy," says Hans.
"My mate in Brussels told me they had a team on site that day. He didn't know why."
"Mad. I saw the call-in chitty, you know, the R2 form."
"You put it on an R2?
"Yeah, why?"
"My mate said it was all informal," says Hans.
"I logged the R2 myself," she says. "What are the interests?"
He shakes his head.
"He just said it seemed odd. Happened with no warning. They normally get at least 24 hours notice on R2s.
"Marcus behaved weirdly all that day. And for a couple of days afterwards too," she says. "He had 2 investigation branch sessions, and he was very jumpy before them. But he wouldn't tell me anything."
Her disappointment at not being Murphy's confidant is palpable.
"What do you think happened?" says Hans.
"He did something, I think,"
says Mel, squinting slightly as she scours her mind for the memories.
"Did something untoward?"
She stops and drops her eyebrows so that she looks grumpy, then looks up at Hans.
"He can't have done something dodgy, can he?"
she whispers. Caroline leaves the house in Highgate earlier than usual and drives to her chambers in Carey Street, near to London's Royal Courts of Justice. On the journey, she cannot get the memories of the previous day from her mind. She is glad that she managed to convince her husband to stay at home and in bed today, as he obviously is going down with something. She makes a note to book him a doctor's appointment when she gets back later. The building that houses the offices of Milson Lawton Hendry is deserted at this early hour, apart from a cleaner rhythmically mopping the black and white tiles of the entrance hallway. The lift is an old-style wire cage that runs up through the centre of a square staircase. She pulls back the concertina outer gate on the fourth floor with a metallic clatter and unlocks the main door to the MLH offices. She drops her coat and bag in her room and makes a cup of tea in the kitchen area at the back of the 10-foot square room that acts as the chamber's reception. As she returns to her office, the telephone on her desk rings in a muted warble. She picks up the receiver, still holding the steaming mug in her hand.
Caroline Lawton?
Clive Tenby from the Cabinet Office, Miss Lawton.
Mr. Tenby, do you have news for me?
Not good, I'm afraid.
She remains silent, knowing what is coming, but not wanting to give away her disappointment.
We have talked to our colleagues in the Secret Intelligence Service, and there is no one called Petrov who works there, he says. Sorry to be the bearer of bad news.
He is smooth, but she can detect in his voice the fact that he knows that he is lying.
Can I say,
of course, he says,
but she ignores it.
I am minded to request a judicial review on the matter.
It is Tenby's turn to be silent as his brain works through the consequences of what she has just said. The silence tells her that Tenby had not prepared for every eventuality of this phone call. He must have assumed, she thinks, that she would just accept his stonewalling.
I'm not sure that would be a good course,
he says eventually.
Thank you for your opinion, Mr. Tenby, but that's not directly relevant in this case, she rolls on. The decision for a judicial review is by way of an application by a claimant or their representative to a judge.
I'm aware of the process, Miss Lawton.
Do you wish to reconsider your response to my initial inquiry?
Under the Intelligent Services Act 1994,
I'm aware of the legislation, Mr. Tenby. There's nothing in that act that states the SIS can retain information that pertains to a criminal case.
It's not common practice to go into details.
Mr. Tenby, I'm not sure you hold the authority needed to make the sort of decisions you're implying to me. Shall we leave it at that? She says. I will talk to my client and follow his direction on an application for judicial review, whether it's common practice or not.
More silence at the other end of the line. Tells Linny that she has won this battle, but she is unsure if it has helped the war.
Have a lovely day, Mr. Tenby.
She rings off, then redials to talk to her client, David McAllister. The hotel that Riverside booked for himself and Catherine is a small guest house in the hills above Nice. Away from the hustle and glittering lights, the countryside around the city quickly reverts to greater normality compared to the implausible glamour of the Côte d'Azur's tanned men and micro-thin women. At breakfast, they talk about the details of the plan for the capture operation that they will deliver today. Riverside insists that Catherine needs to leave her mobile phone in the hotel and places a burner phone on the table between them for her use during the op. She knows that removing known mobile devices from an op zone is common practice to avoid any GPS hacking of agent positions by an enemy. What this tells Kate very clearly is that Riverside is definitely not expecting Black Hawk to come quietly, or the precaution wouldn't be necessary. Riverside explains that he will meet Black Hawk on his own, and that Catherine will be up in the hills behind them as a security precaution. She will not engage unless he gives her a specific order to do so. Catherine is still uneasy about the operation. Riverside repeatedly avoids answering her questions when she asks for more details about what Black Hawk has done. It is clear in her mind that Riverside is expecting her to do just as she's told, whereas her military training tells her that C9 is most effective when they are given decision-making powers in an operation. Intelligence officers like Riverside have less specialized training to cope with a broad range of situations. But if you want a death machine, C9 branch, the snipers, are honed to be the best there is. The two of them finish their meal and Riverside starts to make moves to go, but Kate cannot start the mission without further details. "Rob," she says, putting her hand on his arm to stop him leaving. "You need to confirm something to me before we do this." He sits back down.
"Okay."
"What is the range of our authorized outcomes here?" She searches his face for his honesty. He looks uncomfortable, then takes a large sigh. "We have authority to shoot to kill," he says coldly.
"Shoot to kill?"
She starts to say at normal sound levels, then drops her voice as she remembers where they are.
"That's madness. Who is this woman?"
"She could be dangerous."
"We're all dangerous, Rob. But why is she a danger to us?" says Catherine. "Aren't we all on the same side?"
"Look, I wasn't going to tell you."
Catherine's eyes widen and she urges him to go on with a head movement. "London suspects she's working for a foreign agency."
"Why weren't you going to tell me?"
"Not necessary," says Riverside.
"Bollocks, it isn't," says Catherine. "I'm not some mercenary who you can order about, Rob, for God's sake. C9 is a deadly capability that is deployed in a theatre to enact certain objectives. Going into an op without proper briefing is not how it is done."
She stops and glares at him.
"And don't give me that just following orders bullshit."
Riverside pulls out his phone, selects a screen and places it on the table in front of Catherine.
"There," he says. "Authorization."
She can see an encrypted text from Lawton with the shoot to kill authority.
"All right," she says. "But I reserve the right to use the authority at my discretion. If I consider it appropriate to only injure, then I will do that. This is a member of our own security service. I am not going to kill unless we are in danger."
He reluctantly nods his agreement. They sit in silence for a minute, and she drinks her coffee. "I'll see you in an hour out the front," he says, and walks out of the breakfast room. Stephen wakes at 10 a.m. He didn't sleep until 4, then fell into a hard unconsciousness, and he now feels as though his body has been in one position for the whole night. He showers and has a cooked breakfast. He decides to walk on the heath, as he is feeling better following the shock of the previous evening. After his panic at the sound of Linny saying, "Petrov," he had become more rational. In the sleepless hours lying next to her, before he dozed off, he had put a plan together, which is simply to deny it if anything ever comes out. He turns right out of their front door and down the road that leads directly to the grassland. Then he heads for the Parliament Hill viewing point. He and Linny have stood on this spot many times over the years, and it never ceases to be breathtaking. He falls into the routine of training his eyes on the furthest horizon he can see, and instinctively looks for the differences across the city. He notices new skyscrapers that have appeared in the City of London, and tries to guess which street the cranes are on. Stephen turns away from the view and walks northwards, then descends into the valley that runs across the park, and skirts round towards Hampstead before doubling back to take a wide arc up and over the top half of the heath. As he starts to make his way home, he drops onto the path that leads down the eastern side of the parkland. He rounds the final corner before the gate that leads to his road, and can see something lying prone across the track. As he walks nearer, it looks like a big dog that
is in trouble. The animal must have had some sort of accident. It is not moving, and Stephen quickens his pace in case he can save it, as he doesn't like to see a pet suffering. He reaches the creature and stops, but as he does so, he can see that it isn't a dog. It's a man, lying face down. Lawton bends down to the bundle of clothes and feels for a neck pulse, but finds none. Then he pulls the man's jacket and rolls him over. His heart pounds out of rhythm in his throat. Staring back at Stephen is the blooded and nearly unrecognizable face of Ivan.